The difference between adults and kids is not that they're dumber. It's just that kids are newer.
Coming up on In Contrast, Mo Willems. I'm Ilan Stavans, and In Contrast is a production of New England Public Radio and Quixote Productions. Mo Willems is an author, illustrator, and creator of children's books. He is a 3-time Caldecott Medal winner for Don't Let the Pigeon Drive the Bus, Knuffle Bunny, A Cautionary Tale, and Knuffle Bunny 2, A Case of Mistaken Identity. Willems' books have been translated into a number of languages and turned into animated shorts and theatrical productions. Mo Willems, thank you for being in Contrast. I am delighted. Let me begin by asking you, you are a children's book author. That's your identity. That's who you are. You've always been that way?
No, I don't even know if that's my identity. I feel like author and things like that are given terms. Those are things you earn. You know, Chuck Jones used to say that an artist was a given term. You can, like a saint. You can't wake up one day and say, I'm going to be a saint. I have always wanted to be funny, and I've wanted to be able to draw for a living. Usually that means a cartoonist. So I wanted to be, as a kid, a cartoonist. And ultimately, I consider myself a cartoonist. It's just that instead of working in a daily newspaper, my medium right now is books.
And you always wanted to be funny. Are you funny? Or do you have to work hard at being funny?
You don't want to look like you're working hard. Nobody says, that guy makes comedy look difficult. That's not a compliment. But I like the form of humor. I like the seriousness of humor. I like what it exposes. I like how it challenges the writer and it challenges the listener. So as a form, funniness was interesting to me.
You make the children laugh and you make adults laugh too. Is it different? Does one have to work at being funny or be funny in a different way to adults and to children?
I think there's a dangerous territory. I don't like the idea of writing on two levels, which I think is ultimately what you're getting at. And certainly at Sesame Street, we talk about writing on two levels. I think that implies that a child is somehow lesser. And I am on the kids' side. The difference between adults and kids is not that they're dumber. It's just that kids are newer. They just showed up. They just arrived. So imagine a party. You want to know where the wine is, and you want to know where the cheese is, and you definitely want to know where the bathroom is. So you might be a little awkward in the first couple of minutes because you're trying to get the lay of the land of this party. But you're just as partier as the other partiers who got there first.
I wasn't thinking that the children would be lesser. I was actually thinking that the adults would be lesser. I was thinking that the humor of a child is purer, more natural, more distilled, and that we have to work harder as adults to either laugh or to find the humor in what surrounds us.
I would say that childhood humor or new person humor, it tends to be more philosophical because you don't have cultural modifiers. You know, if I say Eiffel Tower to you, that you know what that is. You have a context of when that was made, what it means, the country that it's in, the symbol that it is. If I say Eiffel Tower to somebody who's never heard those words, it sounds like I'm saying fart. What the joy of writing for children and the challenge of writing primarily for children is that you get to be philosophical. You get to ask the deep Greek questions. Why are people mean? What does it mean to be a friend? Should I share? When should I share? How should I share? Can I drive a bus? Those sort of questions.
We are in the middle of a big national and even further international global discussion on pluralism, on diversity, on what it means to be part of a culture or of a country or of a civilization. When you write for children, do you think of the different segments of childhood, not so much in terms of age, but in terms of how society compartmentalizes them, people that come from a class background and people that come from an ethnic background, a gender background?
Yeah, so I think one of the reasons to use animals is to address that. I want to put 49% of the content in my books, and I let the audience put in the meaning, the 51%. So if you look at Don't Let the Pigeon Drive the Bus, the pigeon is of no distinct race. There is no background. The backgrounds are emotions. There are colors. Elephant and Piggy as well, they're gendered. Piggy is female and elephant is male. But they live in a blank world. So rather than putting them in a suburb that a kid doesn't know what a suburb looks like, or putting them in the country for a kid who comes from a city doesn't know, all of these things can be universalized by minimalizing them by making them as simple as possible. I was very specific when I created Piggy as a female character that I didn't have any accoutrement. There's no eyelashes or Minnie Mouse dresses or anything like that. Her femininity is not an external thing. It is just part of the pigginess of Piggy. And now, in contrast, the Knuffle Bunny books are hyper-specific, but they're also coming from a personal place. And I was aware, obviously, to have the mix of people that are in Brooklyn in the books, but also to show a laundromat and to show a type of school that perhaps kids who live in the suburbs or the country have never experienced. So the metaphor that's often used is mirrors and windows, and I'm aware of that. But I'm trying to keep my books, by and large, as philosophical as possible.
I want you to go a little further on that word that you mentioned, that is one that you mentioned often and that we do in general, emotion, an expression of a particular emotion. I want you to see if you could explain what an emotion is and how you make a character or you present that emotion in a character, because it crossed my mind as you were talking, a famous statement by Thomas Carlyle, who said, "We don't dream of a tiger and feel fear. We feel fear and we dream of a tiger." So when you create a character around an emotion, does the emotion come first?
It's less dogmatic than that. You're creating a character. I'm a method cartoonist. So you draw the pigeon, and the pigeon is a bundle of anxiety, and he's angry, and he's selfish, and all of those things. So while I'm drawing the pigeon, you probably don't want to be in the studio with me. I think that the understanding of how you move your audience, how you make your orchestra read a certain way, how you make it performative, is, for instance, in Don't Let the Pigeon Drive the Bus, I was very influenced by Where the Wild Things Are. Everyone is. And in Where the Wild Things Are, as the fantasy life increases, the white space of the pages decrease and the drawings take over until they actually push the words off of the page. Well, for Don't Let the Pigeon Drive the Bus, it was my first book, and I thought, well, steal from the best. I want to do something with the background that affects the audience, but they're not aware of it. So in that case, all of the backgrounds are colors, but they are like a mood ring. They are an indicator to the emotional state of this pigeon. So the pigeon doesn't live in New York. The pigeon lives in its emotional state. And when it's really angry, the pages are really red. When it's filled with a sort of existential angst, they become gray. And if you notice that manipulation, if you notice that I'm doing that, I've failed. So the key is really to create a reality that doesn't seem drawn, that the ink is wet on the page. It just happened 5 minutes ago. With Knuffle Bunny, it's the same. They look like photographs in the backgrounds, but they're not photographs. They're heavily altered because your eye edits out ugliness. It's why there is beauty in the world. So in the real streets of Brooklyn, there are air conditionings in the window and garbage cans and all of this stuff that if I had left those in the photographs, they would have stolen focus from the emotional impact of the story. So they're deeply, deeply photoshopped images. They just don't feel that way.
I read somewhere that as a child or as an adolescent, you started drawing by copying Snoopy and other characters and that you want your characters to be able to be imitated, to be copied. Explore the idea of imitation and the shaping of an artist in the act, in art of copying, which when we're children is encouraged, but when we're adults is discouraged.
No, I think it's always encouraged. You just have to be more clever about it. The idea is that the reading of the book is an amazing experience. Often you're with an adult that you're very close to, and I'm writing for illiterates, so they're dependent on this adult, and they've got this wonderful moment. But that's not really what it's about. I want my books to be played more than I want them to be read. They should be sparks to something beyond just the consumption of a story. They should be creation-driven. So Don't Let the Pigeon Drive the Bus is an obvious format that's intentional, so that you would come up with Don't Let the Pigeon Eat a Cheeseburger, Be a Skateboarder, whatever is in that kid's mind. So when I design a character, I am spending more time taking lines out than putting them in because I'm trying to make the most basic emotive character that a five-year-old can copy, and immediately an adult would say, oh, that looks like the pigeon, or that looks like Knuffle Bunny, or elephant, or piggy. So it's reductive in that sense. I am most pleased by the moments when I get letters from kids that have adventures with my characters, and their characters start coming in, characters they created, because that means the crutch of my characters is starting to disappear, and they're really on a journey of creation, which is exciting.
There's something both selfish and selfless in what you're just saying. You want your characters to be at the center of a child's imagination or emotion or the connection with the adults, but you also want those characters to disappear or become the characters that the child is going to use to create her or his own characters. Is there a sense that that is what a success would be, that your characters become so ingrained in the imagination or in the landscape that the child is creating that they are no longer yours?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I mean, I feel already that they're no longer mine. I mean, they are kids that are out in college somewhere. You know, I have very little to do with them anymore. What I'm looking for is to create a sandbox that shows ways that you could do it yourself, that makes it without being pedantic, that allows kids to be creative and also allows adults. You know, I'm seeing more and more parents drawing on lunch bags or napkins for their kids. You know, drawing is a physicalized form of empathy. When you draw, you will become inherently empathetic when you draw a cartoon because you're thinking about the character you're drawing. Kids, at some point at 9 years old, let's say, are playing basketball, and most of them realize that they're not going to become a professional basketball player. And that's usually around the same time they realize they're not going to become a professional cartoonist. But they keep playing basketball, and they stop drawing. And I think that that's a shame, because I think that drawing and cartooning, just as an activity, is so exciting and connecting and fun. And it's because their parents aren't drawing. Parents say things like, I can't draw, whatever that is. We, at our dining room, every night, we pull out a giant piece of butcher block paper, and we draw on the table during dinner. And we have a lot of non-artist guests, and perhaps they might be a little intimidated in the beginning, but ultimately, you just start expressing yourself through this drawing and through this doodling. It's great fun.
I was thinking, as you were mentioning, this idea of do it yourself that you take as a mantra, that I can't picture a children's book creator or cartoonist of 80 years ago or 90 years ago saying, the do-it-yourself is my approach that I'm having. It seems to me that that is also very much of the time and space in which we live, where we can become...
Could be. I mean, I would say emotionally, that dealing with emotions is perhaps a little bit more contemporary. But you look at Ed Emberley. I mean, he was making these great, very specific you-can-draw books 30 years ago, 40 years ago. I'm trying to wrap this all up in narrative, and that perhaps may be a little bit different. But I think that there are a lot of people who, over certainly the last century, have really encouraged drawing and doodling as a viable activity.
I want to go deeper into that, but one more question now that you're kind of throwing us back to some of the ancestors that you admire. You talked about Maury Sendak and others. The concept, the item, the product of a picture book is a rather recent phenomenon, say 100 years, 150 years. And the very idea of having the caregiver and the child sitting together and reflecting on what's on the page is also a modern phenomenon. How have we come this way when we often say that after the age in which children fall in love with these extraordinary characters that you and others create, they lose interest in books? They lose interest in the act of reading. That, at least, is the diagnosis that we overhear. Books have lost the gravitas that they used to have. Books are only an excuse in order for a movie to be made. And in some ironic way, it seems to me that the children's book, the picture book, has more of a standing today than books at other ages might have.
Look, I'm not an expert at all. I mean, I'm just a guy who scribbles at home, but I would say that books have enormous cultural import and that kids are reading quite a bit. I think that some of that doom and gloom just comes from the fact that the people who get to complain about what's happening now are old and nostalgic for what they think it was.
And the world before was always better.
I'm sure it was. You know, libraries are incredibly vital right now. Characters and picture books are certainly having a renaissance, a golden age. A picture book is a form of sculpture. They're different sizes. They are one of the few places in terms of entertainment or media, however you want to call it, that you really see the individual who's creating it. It tends to be one or two people. And they're writing and drawing in a very specific and personal way, unlike film and television. And so I think that you get a much deeper appreciation and you love the characters more because of that. And also, you know, in terms of early readers, parents and kids will always remember the first book that a kid read by his or herself. They're not going to remember the first movie a kid saw by his or herself.
And why not?
Well, it's a totally different experience. One is just consumptive and the other is creative. You, by reading a book, you become the book. You change the book. You make it come alive. Otherwise, it's just dead. And it's waiting for you. It's there at any time. You know, a movie is always 84 minutes. That's how long the movie is. But reading a book, a picture book, that could be 4 hours in one reading. It could be 3 minutes. You're in control of the narrative. And because you're putting that narrative out there yourself, you feel an ownership that comes with it. So it's a collaboration between the rough skeleton of an idea and you, the reader.
You say in a number of different places that working for television for Sesame Street was your graduate school.
Yes.
Tell me.
I love sketch comedy, and I started out as a sketch comedian. And I think like any young egocentric, you want to be the voice of your generation. And I got hired by Sesame Street as a writer of grown-up comedy, and they figured they could teach me how to write for kids. And I thought, great, I'm writing sketch, I'm making a living, I get to be with all these great performers, I get to meet all these great writers. But I didn't really think about writing for kids until a couple seasons in. And then I discovered that it was my calling to the degree that a grown-up comic has to write about pop culture. I'm just not interested in the latest band or the latest film or any of that stuff. I'm interested in philosophy. So here was this place where I could do that. And then because it was a television show with a great history and incredible performers, you could write a terrible script and the Muppeteers would make it better. So you were learning on the job and you were learning anonymously. Let's say there's a bad Elmo bit. Nobody would say, boy, some 28-year-old in Brooklyn really made Elmo say dumb things today. Nobody knows. Rather than a book, it's got your name on it.
So what's the difference between the Mo Williams that wrote the episodes, good or bad, in those years that you work at Sesame Street, and the Mo Williams that writes the books, good or bad?
Well, I'm writing a much more personal work. I'm writing about myself in books. I'm writing about issues that matter to me. When you work for a television show, you work for that show. So they have guidelines and they have desires and they want to discuss issues that may not be interesting to you or vice versa. I wanted to write about failure.
You lose your individuality when you're writing?
No, well, yes, you have to speak with a certain voice and there's a bunch of other writers in the room and you guys have to come up with a common voice. I think that's fine. But for instance, again, the failure is a big issue for me. I want to write about failure. The pigeon never gets to drive a bus. And television, they're not so interested in writing about characters who fail.
Are there traces of your apprenticeship, there must be if it was graduate school, in the way the pigeon and Nuffle Bunny
yes.
are shaped? How so?
Don't Let the Pigeon Drive the Bus is the same shape as a television screen at that time. Mm. It's a square, because that's what I was animating to. My work is primarily dialogue-driven. It is characters acting and interacting with dialogue. No, absolutely.
In what way does the written word and the picture universe get married and divorce as you're shaping a book?
They're interdependent. If I write a manuscript and I just take the words and I read the words and that manuscript makes sense, I have too many words. And if I take the drawings without any words and just the drawings on their own and they make sense, I have too many drawings.
So what comes first?
Nothing comes first. They're all the same. I mean, the
writing
is a form of drawing.
Yeah.
Big words, a giant type or small words or putting words to the side or stretching them. That's a type of drawing.
And in the shaping of a book, do you come to a moment where you say, this should not be in words, this should be in images, and this should not be in images, should be in words? Do they clash with each other at any point?
It's a constant form of revisions. There are sketches that inform words that then inform sketches and then fall apart and get brought back together. I mean, it's boring, but it's tedious.
When does a book that you are writing doesn't work? When does it collapse? When do you think this is an aborted project that you don't want to pursue or you want to put it aside? In contrast, that the book is done, the book has legs.
I've definitely struggled with many books that I've put aside or many ideas. Some, by letting them marinate, they've come back and they've managed to do what they need to do. But the metaphor I use is that I'm planting a garden. I'm just always planting ideas and I'm watering them. And sometimes I just have to leave them alone. And sometimes I need to tend them. And some of them grow up to be weeds. And some of them are invasive species and they destroy the hard work of something else. And every now and then a beautiful idea grows to become a beautiful tree that bears fruit that you can cut down and burn for profit.
Is there a way to know when you're planting, when you're seeding, or when these ideas are growing, as it happens to us writers or us thinkers, that something will grow or that something will not?
You have to trust the process. And I think that the craftsmanship aspect is very important. Having done this, having written hundreds of hours of television, having written lots of sketches, lots of books, what I have learned is only one thing, and that is what doesn't work. I now have muscles that are strong enough that I can instinctively tell when something isn't working.
So define for me what doesn't work.
It could be anything. It could be I'm being pedantic. It could be that the writing is too busy. It could be a number of things. I can screw up in a myriad of ways. It's not just one thing. The point is that when you sense that, you just keep working until it is no longer not good. And that's the point that you just have to trust the audience.
And could there be also a process in which something that is good is growing, it's taking shape, but it's overworked?
Yes. I mean, but that's another form of bad.
And what is bad in your eyes about your work, meaning the one that you're going to leave aside, is also bad when you look at other people's work and you say, great talent, but this doesn't work. Or are you, because of the experience that you just defined, because of all those hours that you put in, more attuned and sensitive and in touch with what doesn't work in you, but not with what doesn't work in others?
That answer has changed in the last couple of years. Elephant and Piggy are a series of books that I made. They were easy readers, hard writers, and I developed a pattern and a sense of what worked in these books. And then when I decided to end these books, I, along with my editor and publisher, created basically an imprint of friends of mine who I invite to write books in that style. Elephant and Piggy introduce other authors writing dialogue-driven early readers. And so I'm co-editing these books. And what I have discovered is that the people I'm asking are friends. They're incredibly talented. They've worked in the business for a long time. And not one of them has the same process. Not one of them works in the same way at all. It's remarkable. And none of them work like me. So there's a constant education. You know, some people just come with a shred of a tiny drawing or a character, and then that grows. Other people have fully formed philosophical ideas. Other people don't. And so I have become more and more respectful of others' processes. I don't think that I can say what the right way to do this is. In order for a work to be personal, in order for it to be individual, in order for it to have heart, it has to come from an individual, and an individual has to work in their own way.
The role that an editor in a book like this plays is important, and it can be more important or less important depending on the artist. Finding the right editor for children's books is crucial. There's a kind of empathy of soul, so to speak. Tell me a bit about your history collaborating or finding an editor that you feel understands you. How lucky were you at the beginning? Have you changed? The role of the editor, that invisible hand that is behind, that is crucial to make the book look this particular way.
I've been very, very lucky with the various editors that I've had. My first editor saw Don't Let the Pigeon Drive the Bus, as did hundreds of other editors, and said the exact same thing. They said, that book is unusual. The only difference is my first editor thought unusual was not pejorative. She thought it was a positive. By and large, I think a good editor's job is to be on the side of the kid, always, and to find the potholes. If a story is a road, their job is to say, look, there's a pothole here, a pothole there, and a pothole there, and then my job is to go and fill it. And so in order to be a good editor, you need to be strong, you need to fight for books, you need to fight for your authors, you need to have strong ideas of what makes a good story, and you have to be incredibly modest because you have to let the artist figure out the solution to the problems that are there. I certainly have much greater respect for editors now that I've sort of dipped my toe in it in the last couple of years. It's demanding and it's exciting. And I think that there comes a moment of alchemy where nobody really knows how the dust settled, and that's it at its best.
I want to use what you just said and go back to something we were talking about before, which is diversity and pluralism and that aspect that is part of a larger conversation that all of us are having at different levels. The children's book industry is not only about what we produce for a society made of immigrants like the United States, but it has exploded globally. At the same time, not every culture has the tradition in the depth and complexity of the children's books industry that exists in the United States. To what extent are your characters, Nuffle Bunny and Pigeon, and American characters, to what extent have they been translated to other cultures and they travel because of that simplicity, because of that malleability, plasticity? And to what extent they do not? To what extent this is a phenomenon that really belongs to English and to America, where the child is so precious, so essential, not the same in every culture, for sure.
You know, that's a difficult question to answer because I'm not an expert on this. But I would say what is interesting and has been surprising is which countries have embraced my books and which haven't. I don't think I anticipated that my books would be as popular in Southeast Asia, in China and Japan and Korea, and perhaps less so in Europe. I don't know why that is.
Can you speculate? Is there something maybe minimalistic or attention to certain detail in the art?
It's all butterfly wings. It's hard to say. And, yeah, you know, it's hard enough to create this stuff, much less understand it or understand how it does or what it does in the market. That's really, really is beyond my pay grade. I think that, again, to go back to it, the most exciting thing for me is to see people of many different cultures drawing the pigeon and making their own out of it. That's where the interest is.
Several of your books have been adapted into musicals,
yes,
and you have collaborated in some of them?
I've written them, yes.
Tell me about that experience.
It's great. It's fun. You know, I came from television, which was a highly collaborative industry, and then I got into books, which is collaborative. You have an editor and whatnot, but it's a much more solitary sort of thing. And so making plays has allowed me to be in a room with a bunch of people, allowed me certainly not to be the smartest guy in the room. The only time I'm the smartest guy in the room is when I'm drawing, because I'm the only guy in the room, you know. And so I love doing theater, and I also love children's theater. I love the aliveness, the immediacy, the uniqueness of it. My third musical is about to open up in about a month or so, and it is a rock opera based on a book that I wrote called Naked Mole Rat Gets Dressed. And it's just been great fun. Now, I work with the same dramaturg all the time, which is essentially an editor. I work with the same composer. I have a team. We understand each other. And then we work for different theaters. So far, it's been the Kennedy Center or the Seattle Children's Theater. And I love to talk about doing theater because it's an alchemy. And when people find out that I write children's books at cocktail parties, they'll say, oh, and then they'll say, well, I also do children's plays. They go, ugh, because they're somehow afraid of it. I feel like picture books, we now have museums of picture book art. It's accepted as a viable art form. And children's theater is still the sort of maligned, sort of weird stepchild in the back. But the most exciting types of theater are being done there. Very experimental stuff, very interesting stuff. And the communication is immediate. You know if it works or it doesn't.
And when doesn't it work and when does it? What makes the challenge of making musicals for children particularly challenging? And could it be that it will change when that alchemy that you were describing becomes more ingrained?
It's also just a level of quality. There just are a lot of interesting theaters making a lot of interesting theater for children. And it is not the sort of pedantic, silly, I don't know what vision you have. I think you have a vision of somebody in a big hat and a kazoo telling you how to table manners or something like that. There's a lot of nuance in it. And there are a lot of people, again, who are very passionate about their audience. And there is theater for young people. There are theater for very young people. There are pieces of theater that are created specifically for toddlers, these 20-minute pieces that are incredibly interactive and expansive. There is a lot of theater for children to perform that is written so that every kid has a part in a play and that they can really experience and perform something together. There's so much that can be done in this particular sandbox. And much like cartooning wasn't taken seriously for a while so you could get away with stuff, the same sort of thing happens for children's theater. Because it is ignored, you get to have a little bit more fun.
And in this collaborative view that you present of theater and of children's books and of television, where experimenting, bringing the kid in, being playful, could you imagine movies also having that effect? Or movies are more flat because there's nothing happening on that screen other than shadows moving around. So you work on television and you worked on theater and you work on creating your books. Any allure that the big screen is projecting through you that might tell you you can do something here that you haven't done anywhere else?
There are a lot of great movies for kids being made by a lot of great studios. Obviously, Pixar does incredible work. It's a different beast than what I've been working with. There is something great about the type of theater that I'm working on, in that it is a small group. You can make a small piece. I don't think you can really make a small film. The idea of making a minor motion picture is not really possible.
And then there is that other collaboration that you, or participation that you've been involved in and that I have followed your work through the last few years, and that is in museums.
Yes.
And you are about to have an exhibit that will start in Pittsburgh and then mm-hmm. will travel for a decade into
yes.
different cities. Tell me about the role of museums in your own vision of how storytelling, narrative, engaging children. And I understand that this exhibit will change depending on the city.
Yes.
And so what is about the universal, but also the particular of that city?
Well, there are two different things. So the exhibits that I've had up until this time have been art exhibits. And primarily...
Your work projected on the wall.
Yeah, framed on the wall.
Right.
What's been great about that is there's a sense of acceptance of this as art, but more importantly, a demystification. A lot of my work comes from high art. Paul Klee, Calder, Picasso, all of these people have an influence. And I think museums can be seen as somewhat terrifying. But if you're going to go see a cartoon pigeon or you're going to go see a cartoon elephant or a pig, you might then go to other areas of the museum and start to see connections. Hanging art at much lower so that it's at the eye level of a kid is really exciting. The High Museum in Atlanta, which is the major municipal museum, they started doing shows. They had one of Ashley Bryant recently, and they've been so successful in bringing in new audiences and making new connections that they have made a commitment to having more art exhibits of juvenilia. And that is incredibly exciting. 10 years ago, no museum would touch picture book art. And a lot of that has to do with the work that the Eric Carle Museum has done to sort of legitimize this stuff. I mean, it's beautiful illustration by many different types of artists in many different ways. The exhibit that I have going on in Pittsburgh is a children's exhibit. It is a touchy-feely process thing. It has physical praxinoscopes, which are, you know, basically large mirrors that can create animation. There are digital videos of how to draw my characters. There are games or dress-up things. There is a room based on a book that I wrote called Waiting Is Not Easy, where you essentially wait for the night to arrive. It creates an anticipatory sense of just being patient. So this is a much more of a you-can-do-it-too, a play exhibit. And so I'm excited about that. All of these projects... I've been working on this Pittsburgh show with the Pittsburgh Children's Museum for two and a half years, really trying to distill what it is that I would love to have happen, not to a kid in the room, but when they get home.
And in the process, the museum itself is becoming less scary because it is less static too.
Yes. A museum has a show. That's exciting. It's a show. Right? It should be inviting. It should be accessible in some way. And a lot of great art, rather than intimidating, could be inviting. Again, all of these things are empathy. When you go to a museum and you look at something, you're being forced to empathize with the artist, being forced to empathize with the image. That is, to me, exciting.
And when you think of a picture book, implied in your answers early on in our conversation is the fact that there is a caregiver, a parent or a teacher mm-hmm. who is sitting with the child and there is a dialogue between the two. When it comes to an exhibit, how are you envisioning in this Pittsburgh one that is going to travel, mm-hmm. for instance, at least two audiences? And I know you don't like to divide this into a double consciousness here, but you're having two audiences at least,
yes, right.
the adults. And even in where you hang certain stuff right. on the wall, you are either privileging somebody that is taller or shorter or what have
yes.
you.
Well, I'm always going to be on the side of the kids. I mean, that's easy because the world isn't. You know what I mean? Exactly. Most of the museums, the paintings are too high. You know, somebody's got to pick you up so that you can see it. I do think in terms of my picture books as having an audience, I'm a composer and I have an orchestra, and that is the reader. The reader has a great advantage over my illiterate listeners in that they can read it. And as a parent myself, when my kid was young, if you read a book that bored you, you read it in a bored manner. So I want to make sure that my orchestra is jazzed. And you've seen a symphony where you can tell that the musicians are like, oh, this one again, come on, you got to be kidding. And then every now and then they get a new piece or a great piece, and they're really jazzed to be there. So I am aware that I want my work to be performative. Most adults don't realize this, but adults are cool. And adults being silly is crazy. That's crazy cool. Because usually adults say, well, I blah, 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 blah. And if they say anything of interest, it's usually what you can't do. But now you get a book and you get to scream and yell and say, oh, no, there's a bird on my head. Blah. That is just rock and roll. That's crazy.
To conclude, you have a little notebook before you and you have been drawing or doodling. And at the very beginning, I said, are you doodling? And you said there's a difference before we started mm-hmm. between a doodle and a drawing. Can
yes.
you explain to me?
A drawing is intentional. There are good drawings and bad drawings. When I'm making a book, I am drawing. I am trying to hit a certain pose. I want the character to look a certain way. And if the character doesn't look or feel the way that I want it to, crumple, 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 get rid of it. A doodle is something completely different. It's entirely about process. It's about letting your mind go. And there's no such thing as a wrong doodle. And that doodle can feed into a drawing. I mean, I can doodle a character at the dining room table or just while I'm on the phone for years and years and then say, guess what? You've graduated to a drawing. And then I can start to draw it.
So explain to me now the relationship between the hand that I see moving on that notebook and your mind. The way your mind can feel liberated because your hand is moving and expressing all these ideas
yeah.
and vice versa. How does that work?
That's the magic of it. That's what makes doodling so great. So we draw every night at the dining room table. My father-in-law was a businessman. He did not like the idea of drawing every night at the dinner table. He likes spreadsheets. But if you want to eat, you're going to doodle. So that's just the way it is. So he started to make spreadsheets on the table, just grids. And they were great. That's a really nice spreadsheet. And then over the years, those spreadsheets started to grow and wave and start to become colors. And now he searches out museums to find new color combinations so that he can make these abstractions that are beautiful. And I promise you, at this point, a decade into it, you wouldn't say, that looks like a really good spreadsheet. But it all came from that doodling. It just came from drawing what you were comfortable with and then
moving. But your mind would not be, or your hands would not be moving the same speed in the same agitated way as I see them right now if you were not letting the doodles exist.
Right. Well, and I'm not doing it now because I'm looking at you, but when I'm on the phone, I'm always drawing. And I did as a kid in my notebook. That's how I was able to listen. I wasn't looking at the teacher. I was drawing. And the drawings may have had nothing to do with what the lecture was, but I was still taking it in some way. It's a pleasure.
It has been a pleasure having you here. Thank you so much, Mo Willis.
Thank you. Nice segue.
A dot that becomes a line, that becomes a circle, that creates a spiral that is built into a structure that transforms into a landscape that, in drawing, we represent our reality. But we also learn to think. How does the dot become a line and the line a circle? What are the motions that my hand is doing for these signs to manifest themselves on the page? And how is my mind wandering as my eyes follow the traces that my hand creates? Children learn through play, and drawing is an essential part of it. We give pencils and crayons and brushes, paint and paper to children in order for them to experiment. We don't want a Picasso. We want chaos. For in chaos, there is life. From chaos comes order, and order is made through trial and error, through repetition, through the exercise of seeing what we can do when we don't know what we're necessarily doing. Drawing isn't only about what comes out on the page. It is about the connections the mind makes while the artist is at play, the ideas that are born, the stories that take shape as narratives. That's what we're after, an imagination that is loose, unframed, explosive. The mind is in the act of creation when it is in sync with the body's explorations. It will go to unforeseen places. It will find its own contours, its own possibilities. A dot and a line are more than a dot and a line. They are individuality. They are affirmation. They are a sense of self. They are responsibility. They are power. Next time on In Contrast.
Even if he had lost, we would be living in a country where tens of millions of people voted for Donald Trump. That in itself is something that demands a reckoning. And the successive focus on Russia and its role in the election delays that reckoning.
A look inside Russia today with Masha Gessen. Let us know what you think about In Contrast. Review us on Apple Podcasts or send an email to radio@nepr.net. You can also follow us on Facebook, where we invite you to share your comments on this program and others in our series. Our interns are Delina Hatgu and Jacob Pagano. Our music is by the Fresh Cut Orchestra. The executive producer of In Contrast is John Vosey. I'm Ilan Stavans. Thank you for listening. In Contrast is a production of New England Public Radio and Quixote Productions.